The story of power invested in a mild, unassuming man who had it within his authority to turn our war between the states into a worldwide conflict. Humiliated, frustrated, sorely tried and tempted, he played a desperate waiting game until he was forced to use his trump card with the stakes, the future destiny of the United States. But that is the story. Broadcasting Company presents Tales of the Foreign Service, one of a series presented by NBC's University of the Air, written and produced in cooperation with the State Department, and dedicated to the personnel of the Foreign Service. The material used in this series is based upon the confidential files of the State Department, much of it never before released to the public. Is about an unsung hero of the war between the states. The story of Charles Francis Adams, grandson of John Adams and son of John Quincy Adams, who, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln, was as much responsible as anyone for the preservation of the Union. Situation in the spring of 1861 was fraught with peril to the Union and to the newly inaugurated President Abraham Lincoln. All was uncertainty. Southern officers in the Army and Navy of the United States were daily resigning and linking their fortunes with a Confederate cause. The federal authorities were afraid to act lest they precipitate hostilities. In striking contrast to this indecision was the marked energy of the new Confederate government, which was gathering troops, quoting money and supplies, and rapidly preparing for the issue. Shortly before the capture of Fort Sumter, Charles Francis Adams was summoned to Washington by the new Secretary of State for the Union, William H. Stuart.
Well, don't look so serious, Charles. The stories about Mr. Lincoln are greatly exaggerated.
And I'm very grateful to you, Mr. Stewart, for this appointment. I only hope I am equal to the task.
It's an important one. And don't call me Mr. Stewart. After all, we're old friends.
Oh, thank you, William. England seems so far away. Makes me sad to leave America just when I might be of some use in this war that seemed inevitable.
I can't overemphasize the importance of your being at the court of St. James. The action of foreign governments, especially of England, may decide the outcome of whether the Union shall hold or the Confederates win.
William, I have the feeling that Mr. Lincoln would have been happier with Mr. Bates.
Never mind, Charles. He is perfectly satisfied.
And it almost seems like exile.
Nonsense. I'm not overstating the matter too much when I say you may well have in your hands, before these storm clouds have been driven away, the power to force England and France and maybe other nations into war, either on our side or worse, against us.
Mr. Adams left Boston on May the 1st, 1861. But in the meantime, Fort Sumter was fired on. While the newly appointed ambassador was on the high seas, Lord John Russell, the British Minister of Foreign Affairs, received a visitor in London.
Who is it?
It is Mr. Yanchen, my lord.
Well, don't let the man stand out in the wet.
Come in, Mr. Yanchen. I've been expecting you.
Ah, thank you, my lord.
Take his wet coat, please, and dry and come to the kitchen fire.
Yes, my lord.
Come into my study, Mr. Yanchen. This way.
Ah, that fire looks good.
Speaking of fires, I've received the news.
For Sumter?
Yes.
Well, Lord John,
as your astute mind has already observed, we're extremely sympathetic to the Southern cause.
You mean that Mr. Ross and I may expect a British recognition of the Confederacy?
Not so far. Yes, help know the wisdom of the inevitable cause of action. England is in a difficult position at the moment, Mr. Yankee. A difficult official position.
You mean the length of your situation?
Yes. The workers in the cotton industry and certain other blocks of interest among the laboring classes are keenly interested in the anti-slavery question. It is impossible to present a united front at this moment. Lord Palmerston and I see a light on the matter. And even Her Majesty.
Speaking of the Majesty, the South has its own royalty. Cotton is king, my lord. How can the Lancashire workers be unsympathetic to the very stuff which puts bread into their mouths?
Yes, it's all so complicated, gentlemen. Just now, a civil war has been formally declared between you and the Union. We find large stockpiles of cotton in our country. It will be some weeks, perhaps months, if all the stock exchange and even the laboring man feels the pinch. Until the common man does feel the pinch, Mr. Yankee, it would be inadvisable to take a rash step.
Then you will declare England as a neutral?
Her Majesty has her own ideas about that. Keep in touch with me.
A week later, Mr. Adams arrived at the embassy with his wife. And the next morning, over breakfast, Mr. Dallas, the retiring ambassador, brings an interesting matter to Mr. Adams' attention.
India or China, sir?
What did you say, Adam?
Your team, sir. Strong or weak?
Better take it strong, Mr. Adams. Have you seen the papers?
No, Mr. Dallas.
There you are. The Queen has issued a proclamation of neutrality.
Neutrality? Why, that's impossible.
Is it true?
It probably means that England will recognize the Confederacy.
A serious blow, Mrs. Adams. Frankly, I don't envy your staying here. Mr. Lincoln is most unpopular. He's regarded as an uncouth boor. And I'm afraid we are regarded as a race of roughnecks. Representing a roughneck isn't going to help you here. But anyway, good luck. Better luck than I've had. You'll need it.
Troubled by the ominous undercurrent which the sensitive Mr. Adams was quick to perceive, he made a characteristically straightforward move. He decided to beard the lion in his den, the British lion in this case being Lord John Russell.
I see I could observe the etiquette of your position, Mr. Adams. Won't you sit down?
Thank you. I believe you will agree with me, Lord John, that these are times in which we can well afford to dispense with formality.
So? God needs to see you, Mr. Adams. I've been informed of Mr. Lincoln's blockade of the Southern Court.
News which I'm sure does not surprise you, seeing that a state of civil war exists in my country. But I am concerned, Lord John, with what I believe an even more important act on the part of Her Majesty's government. This neutrality proclamation, how can we recognize a government which does not exist?
Since you choose to be French, you must know that agencies of faith and services government do exist under your very nose here in England. It is a choice, as I see it, between two presidents.
I can see your position in the matter of cotton. But more important than that of the rights of man and the importance of union. Your own efforts in behalf of holding together your vast empire must remind you of the necessity of cohesion.
What is the purpose of your visit, Mr. Adams? Our position is quite clear, it seems to me.
The trouble is, it is not clear, my lord. I should appreciate knowing your real feelings, so there can be no misunderstandings between us.
They are neutral.
a curious word.
It is possible we may not be for long. Although I cannot explain that, except to remind you that there are interests outside things. France, for example, which are dependent on the cotton output of the south of your country.
War against us, then, is a possibility?
I should be safer.
Lord John, you will understand that the government which I represent will not close its eyes to what is happening here.
Speaking unofficially, Mr. Adams, one of the sad differences between a government such as mine and the government such as yours is that a new concept, a new government, is sometimes an impermanent state.
I am sure your lordship understands the advisability of waiting to see what is permanent and what impermanent. Good day, my lord. I can't understand, Abby, exactly what is expected of me.
These are troubled times, Charles.
If I were persuaded that Her Majesty's government really desires to favor the rebellion, I should ask for a forthright answer. But all around me, I see division of public opinion. Abby, I have the feeling the government is for the South, but England is for us.
Can't you stay as it comes, Charles? The Union is far away, and we don't know their problems. You can only try to solve your problems here with Yankee common sense. Oh, there is a chance for you, my dear. I'll go.
Thank you. Oh, it's you too.
Good news?
It's confidential.
Then I'll go and leave you to everything.
My dear Charles, I am enclosing a copy of a memorandum entitled Thoughts for the President's Consideration. It is important that you read it and grasp the significance of my reaction to what is taking place in Spain.
I would demand explanations from Spain and France, Great Britain and Russia. And if satisfactory explanations were not received, would convene Congress and declare war against them. It is probably to be in your hands, Charles, whether we declare war on England. Bide your time. Watch and wait. And if necessary, at the right moment, you have the authority of the United States to strike.
Strangely strengthened and comforted by this verbal dynamite, Adams decided to talk to Russell again. His second interview was seemingly no more successful in bringing the British Minister for Foreign Affairs out in the open. But Adams' forthright and straightforward manner had won the British's respect. So his directness in dealing with Russell won him, after all, his first objective. The Confederate agents, Messrs. Yancey, Ross, and Mann, were not received again by Russell. So on the surface, then, Adams was making progress. However, he was to find the sand shifting under his feet again. Rumors came to him of circumvention by the British of the blockade. British ships were sailing to Nassau in the Bahamas and then transferring their war cargoes into fast light ships in which the Confederates could easily run the blockade. England was supplying the South and aiding the war, but again, unofficially. At this point, Adams made his next move.
I have come to make another request of you, your lordship. Unpleasant rumors are reaching the embassy, which I'm sure can only be false. My government has asked me to invite you to join with us in the recognition of the rules of neutrality, which came out of the Declaration of Peace.
That is due respect, Mr. Thomas. Under the Declaration of Paris, we are allowed to deliver our gifts to what we may seriously call the enemy.
My point, I think, is clear, Lord John. If Britain comes out openly for this document, then we know where we stand. The United States is prepared to sign it.
This could be tantamount to a treaty with the Union, would it not, Mr. Ludden?
It simply ensures no mutual interference with our prosecution of the war.
England might sign, yes. Provided we insert the clause that the terms of this treaty have no bearing, direct or indirect, on the internal difficulties now prevailing in the United States.
Thank you for clarifying your position, Lord John.
Come again, Mr. Ruddin.
Good evening, my lord.
Good evening, Mr. Ruddin. Oh, nevertheless, I like you, Mr. Ruddin. Yes, I like you very well indeed.
Adams, depressed, arrived back home to receive further stunning news.
I'll get some supper, Charles. I'm sorry it's been a bad day.
My something's troubling you, Abby. What is it?
You hear it anyway. The Union has suffered a terrible defeat. The Confederates have marched on Washington and almost taken it.
Yes.
It's all here in the paper.
Not so sure, Lord John.
We aren't very popular here in England, are we? Just as Mr. Ballas predicted.
Popular?
It's no longer pleasant to walk the London streets. Only today when I was talking to a woman here. It happens every day. But what's so worried? It really funny sometimes. Only I guess so.
And the question is, what sort of home will we have to go back to, Robbie?
When I get very late, Charles, as I was today, I read that letter of your father. And I realize how huge the letter is.
Oh, yes.
You remember? I know it by heart. You must make up your mind to meet and encounter opposition and defeat and slanders and treachery, and above all, fickleness of popular faith. Fortify your mind against disappointment. Keep up your courage and go ahead.
The Adamses were popular with one family in England, and shortly thereafter they were invited by Richard Monckton Milnes and his wife down to their country place, Clydesdale.
I hope you like Pompous Castle. The room was just over there.
Oh, yes. You remember Richard II, Abbey. It's here he was murdered.
Mm, it looks peaceful and serene now.
We'll get off here. Here, I'll help you down, Mrs. Abbey.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll help Mrs. Milnes down, if I may.
Thank you. What is it? Now, don't tell me they caught up with you, Charlie. It looks like a message.
Mr. Adams?
Yes?
Message for you, sir.
Oh, thank you.
Shall I wait for an answer?
Yes, please.
I'm sorry, Mr. Adams. You look unhappy.
Well, there's nothing secret about it. Two Confederate agents have just been taken off a British packet that sent on the high seas by one Captain Wilkes, commanding one of our vessels. And this is just the sort of thing I've criticized in the Confederates.
This means you will have to return to London?
Not at all. No. No, I think it's better that Lord John cool off a bit before he finds me. No message.
Yes, sir.
Come along. What was the exact spot where Richard was murdered, Mr. Milley?
Trent affair threw the British people into sudden anger. When Mr. Adams was seeking for the proper diplomatic answer which would hold catastrophe at bay, a Mr. Dudley, Adams' consul at Liverpool, paid a sudden visit to the embassy in London.
There is no doubt, Mr. Adams, that the Confederates are still running the blockade with British help. I have conclusive proof that ships are taking off from Liverpool to Nassau and rendezvous with the South at that point.
You come at a very advantageous time, Mr. Dudley. I need this weapon, and I need all the proof you can give me.
That's not the whole story. Our ships are not allowed to coal in Nassau Harbor, which is rank discrimination.
Tell me, is all this in that packet of papers?
Yes. It's been devilishly difficult to obtain this proof because, as you know, Liverpool is strongly pro-Confederate. But the worst news of all is that the British are building ships, war ships, for the South.
Are you positive?
Yes. There's a Captain Bullock from the Confederate side dealing with one of the biggest shipbuilders in England, Mr. Laird.
Well, I wonder what my Lord John Russell will have to say about this.
Ask him about Project 290.
I'll force him out into the open. At last, Dudley, thanks to your proof, I'll force my Lord John Russell into the open.
Well, my lord, what is your explanation? Believe me, Mr. Evans, I knew nothing of Mr. Laird's contact with the Confederates.
Yes, but you do agree that the building of these ships is a violation of neutrality.
Yes, but my government knows nothing officially of it.
You may regard my call as official. You may regard my telling you as official notice. Now then, what are you going to do?
I'll stop it, of course.
Thank you, my lord.
The first ship built under Confederate contract with Laird was completed. This was Project 290. The notorious Alabama, whipped by a freak chance beyond Russell's control, slipped down the waves and out to sea, where it was taken over by the famous Confederate captain, Raphael Sims. And Lord Russell's explanation of this was exasperating.
But, Mr. Adams, you have proof that I gave a detention order for Project 290.
You should have seen that those orders went through to Liverpool.
They went through the normal channel.
Yes, and fell into the hands of Sir John Hastings.
Could I help it if he had a nervous collapse and postponed action on the order? There are half a dozen other important matters which you never acted on, too, Mr. Adams.
I care nothing about these other matters. I am responsible to my government for stopping this shipbuilding.
It has been taken care of.
Whatever that means, my lord. The point is, this must not happen again. It's too late to stop the Alabama, but we will not tolerate another such incident. Do I make myself clear, Lord John?
Sweet Bostonian held the powerful Lord John Russell, now Earl Russell, in check. The defeat of having the Alabama slipped through his hands was turned into a victory. Here was a new sword to parry with the English government while still playing the waiting game. Russell's position was becoming untenable, particularly when across the broad reaches of the Atlantic came the strong, clear voice of Lincoln proclaiming,
"Freedom! Freedom! Freedom! I proclaim freedom from slavery!"
The Emancipation Proclamation, how wisely timed in the international days. Lincoln's chief objective up to that time had been to save the Union. Now he could afford to come out with a second objective, freedom for the slaves. It was a clear-cut stand on an issue which needed clarifying in England. And Lincoln's voice was clear to all who heard. British papers supported Lincoln and the Union.
This capital in human flesh is anathema to the British.
Long live the United States of America.
We can live without coppers, but we can't live without liberty.
Adams, with shrewd Yankee patience and ability to bide his time and seize opportunity where he saw it, believed he had won until...
Where have you been, sir? Mr. Dudley's been waiting all afternoon for it.
Oh, I've been walking. Did he come all the way from Liverpool?
Yes, I took him.
Well, thank you, dear.
Come in, Mr.
Adams.
Thank you. I'll leave you
just a minute. The Laird firm is at it again, Mr. Adams.
Oh, you must be mistaken.
No. There are two new ships under construction, much worse than the Alabama. Larger, equipped with every battery and modern appliance of war. They call them rams. I tell you that no steam, wooden ship, or monitor can possibly cope with them.
Oh, how dare you. Russell has gone too far this time.
The scheme is to invade New York and Boston. And they can. The Union has nothing to throw against them.
This is the last straw. The Alabama adds new depredations daily, thanks to my Lord John's evasion. If these new ships go through, it means the end of us.
This was the darkest hour of a long night. Word came from Washington, from the Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
We must stop from their rams at all hazards, as we have no defense against them. With the guns, we have not one in the whole country set to fire at them. It is a question of life or death.
Mr. Seward sent word.
There will be left for the United States no alternative but to protect themselves and their commerce against armed cruisers proceeding from British forces against the naval forces of a public enemy. If, through the necessary employment of all our means of national defense, such a war shall become a general one between the two nations, the President thinks that the responsibility for the painful results will not fall upon the United States. Work in the shipyards of the Laird brothers pushed steadily forward all through the winter. Sheds lighted with gas were erected over the warship so as to ensure additional hours of labor upon them. And matters were approaching a climax as the great ship neared completion. The first of the Laird warships took to the water at Birkenhead on the 4th of July, 1863. At this critical time, Mr. Adams decided to take another tack, since alone he could not get Earl Russell to act. He decided to visit a member of the cabinet, the Duke of Argyle, who was a friend of the Union, and thus bring pressure on Russell from still another source within his own government.
You are a member of the cabinet, today, and I wish to impress upon you the grave and critical nature of the situation. You have been misled by Confederate agents. The building of these rams is an overt act of enmity to the Union. As an old friend, I should like to observe that my official instructions on the subject are far more stringent than I have yet been disposed to execute. Need I say more?
It's what the say is true, Sir Adams. I have a letter to write. I think the Earl Russell should know the truth about this.
Well, my lord, this may perhaps be my last visit.
I do not understand, Mr. Evans.
I mean, Lord John, that the waiting game is over.
Your waiting game?
All this time, ever since I arrived in England, you have been the one to act, and I the one to sit back and wait. My patience and the patience of my government is at an end.
But wait a moment.
I've waited moments, hours, days, weeks. Now I must act. I know what the official view is on the Laird rams, that they were built under contract for a French firm. Well, you and I know that is a subterfuge.
Mr. Laird is a private contract.
I'm sick of that explanation. What is done by the Laird Shipbuilding Company is a matter of concern to England as of this moment. If those rams sail from Liverpool, it will be a serious day for you, my lord, and a serious day for England.
Then, I am to understand...
In plain Yankee language, your lordship, this is war.
All through the next 48 hours, Adams waited, watching all dispatches, all newspapers, the news of governmental action. And Dudley at Liverpool could supply no further information as to the fate of the Laird warship. When finally, after two nights of sleepless vigil, Adams dropped off through sheer exhaustion to talk in nightmarish distress at the possible consequences of his act, he was awakened 2 days after his interview with Russell.
I'm sorry to wake you, Charles, but something tremendous has happened.
War. It's come at last.
Charles, the Morning Post, look. The government has decided on detaining the rams. We are going to try the merits of the case in court. You've won, Charles. You've won.
Years after Mr. Adams stopped the British threat, James Russell Lowell was to say of him,
"None of our generals in the field, not Grant himself, did us better or more fine service than he in his forlorn outpost of London. He passed a victory not less renowned than war."
You've been listening to Tales of the Foreign Service, one of a series presented by the NBC University of the Air. written and produced in cooperation with the State Department and based on confidential State Department files.